Today we are talking all things narcissism. Narcissism isn't just a personality trait that shows up in advice columns, it's a set of traits classified and studied by psychologists. We dive deep into the psychology behind the elevated and sometimes detrimental self-involvement of narcissists, then we answer your questions on relationships. Hello everybody, welcome back to another episode. I am Kat, I am a registered psychologist.
And I'm Amy, a registered psychotherapist. Today we are talking all things narcissism.
I'm sure we've all probably had some experience with a narcissist in our life, whether you've dated one, you've got an overconfident boss, you have maybe had experience with an authoritarian parent, or maybe even an entitled friend. We all know a narcissist in some way or another. Amy, have you ever had experience with a narcissist in your life or in your practice?
Yeah, like you said, I think we've all had one or two experience with a narcissist. Or someone with narcissistic traits anyway. And I think it is really interesting. And I think there are a lot of different types of narcissism that come out in a lot of different roles, which make it interesting.
Yeah. And it is something that you don't realize is a narcissist until you go through the diagnostic criteria and you can like, oh yeah, like I know one of those people. And narcissism is a personality disorder. It's characterized by a pattern of grandiosity. I love that word, grandiosity. So someone who's very egotistical, they might have a need for admiration, and they may also express a lack of empathy. So people who can't empathize and feel the feelings that other people feel. Narcissistic traits generally begin by early adulthood, and as you said, Ames, can present in a variety of contexts. So what are some signs of a narcissist, Amy?
Okay, so people have been obsessed with self long before selfies. Psychologists have studied narcissism for a very long time. Thank you. And we often define it as an inflated, grandiose self-image. To varying degrees, narcissists think they're better looking, smarter, and more important than other people. They also tend to think they deserve special treatment, and psychologists recognize two forms of narcissism as a personality trait. And that's, like you said, Kat, the grandiose and a vulnerable narcissism. There's also, like Kat mentioned, the narcissism personality disorder or narcissistic personality disorder, which is a more extreme form. But when we look at narcissists that maybe don't fit a diagnostic criteria or a diagnosis, we refer to the grandiose and the vulnerable. So grandiose narcissism is the most familiar kind, and that's characterized by extroversion, dominance, attention seeking. They tend to pursue attention and power. So think of people that might be in roles like a politician, a celebrity, a cultural leader. Of course, not all individuals who are in those roles are narcissists, but those who are narcissists do it for the status and for the attention that goes with it. Then there's vulnerable narcissists, which can be a little bit more quiet and reserved. They have a strong sense of entitlement, but are easily threatened by others.
Yeah, absolutely. So it takes a bit of time to spot a narcissist. And I think generally in my experience with people that I've known personally and people that I've known in my practice is that it does take a bit of time to learn about their story and learn about their behavior to diagnose narcissism. It's not an instant thing you can instantly diagnose. It's something that does take a bit of time, I think, because narcissists are so good at charming people and they're so good at building a story and creating an image about them that it actually takes a bit of time for it to undo that. So they're not easy to spot instantly. It does take a bit of time to learn about them and their behaviors and how they react to others in their life that you start to realize, you know, you can start to identify a narcissist. So according to the DSM-5, so that's the diagnostic statistical manual, which I guess helps us as mental health professionals to diagnose one. So to be diagnosed with narcissistic personality disorder, a narcissist has a grandiose sense of self-importance, as Amy said before. Even though they may not have any significant achievements, they still believe that they are more important than other people. They are preoccupied with fantasies of an unlimited success, power, brilliance, beauty, or an idealized love, often that they can never reach. People with narcissistic personality disorder believe that he or she is very special and unique and can only be understood or should only associate with other people of high of high status. They require a lot of admiration and a lot of attention. As Ames was saying as well, they've got a sense of entitlement. They are generally pretty exploitive and manipulative of other people, and they do tend to take advantage of others. They lack empathy, and they are most often envious of others and believe that others are very envious of them, and they tend to be quite arrogant. So that's really in a nutshell, but I think, you know, there are some more subtle ways that you can spot a narcissist as well.
Definitely. And the clinical diagnosis affects 1-2% of the population and is actually more common in men than in women. And we also don't diagnose children, so the diagnosis is left for 18 years and over, because children can by nature be quite self-centered. And that's pretty normal for their development.
Absolutely. So, yeah. If you know a child who is self-centered, that's completely normal. So please don't diagnose your child.
They're not narcissistic. They just can't fend for themselves.
So this criteria captures really important aspects of narcissistic pathology. I'm going to have a real struggle saying narcissistic. They provide an inadequate explanation of the broader population of individuals who receive a diagnosis. So I think also the problem I have with this diagnostic criteria is it kind of fails to cover other core psychological features of the disorder. So, for example, I've seen in my practice with people who are narcissists or do present with those real narcissistic characteristics and personality traits that a lot of them have been through perhaps some trauma. They've got quite low and vulnerable self-esteem. They might have feelings of inferiority. They might feel extremely bored. They might have had some attachment issues growing up, and they might be extremely reactive to distress. So overconfidence and extreme egotistical behaviors is likely to be overcompensatory behaviors, which narcissists construct generally. So this is a protective barrier, which kind of protects them from the external world, which they might have learned to mistrust. So sometimes with narcissists is that they perhaps have been through some trauma. I know, Ames, you'll probably have a little bit on trauma as well. And their way of compensating for their trauma is almost like creating this image or this person that isn't real to kind of protect them from the outside world and things that they don't trust.
Yeah, I think what you're referring to is something that we call the false self. So when people have experienced deep trauma, we tend to learn maladaptive coping strategies to meet our own needs. And part of that might be developing narcissistic traits. So it's not actually that the person believes that, you know, they are the best at everything, like the grandiose narcissism. It's the vulnerable narcissism. So it, like Kat mentioned, actually comes from a deep insecurity. And those narcissistic qualities or traits are developed as a way of meeting someone's needs that maybe didn't receive much praise or positive reinforcement. So they kind of positive reinforce themselves. And then you have the opposite end of the spectrum, where some develop narcissistic traits by having parents that put their child on a pedestal. So yeah, you can see opposites in that sense, I think.
Yeah. Interestingly as well, narcissists are more likely to have more friends, they're more likely to receive promotions, and they're actually more than likely to get paid more than normal. The studies have shown that people who do have high levels of narcissism also tend to be more resilient and have lower rates of depression and stress than their peers. Isn't that crazy? So, you know, narcissism, it is a bit of a protective barrier, I guess, against something, things that have happened to them in some instances. And it's very easy for narcissism to come across as confident, as having a bit of an ego. But I guess what's really good to know is, when does that confidence tip over to overconfidence? And when does the ego begin to take over empathy and insight? I think it is, you probably know someone who has got these narcissistic traits, but you're kind of not sure whether they are extremely narcissistic. And I feel like narcissism is thrown around so much. I mean, as soon as you meet someone who's confident, you know, they might get labeled a narcissist really quickly. And I think because, especially in the culture we're in today, it's actually quite abnormal to be so highly confident, that as soon as we might come across someone who is very confident within themselves and is very proud of their achievements, it's actually looks quite abnormal to us. And we might label that as narcissistic.
Well, I think it comes down to confusing confidence with an inflated ego. I think someone that is confident is very different to someone that has an elevated sense of self, which is what we see when we look at someone who has narcissistic traits. And what, when we talk about personality disorders, what makes it, I guess, what crosses the line is that it impacts their daily life. We talk about that a lot when it comes to any kind of personality disorder. When is it a problem? Well, it's a problem when it impacts someone's life. And people with narcissism lack the comprehensive knowledge of emotions. So it's, we know as people without personality disorder that feelings of sadness, love, anger are all very normal emotions to feel. Whereas people with narcissism experience those emotions as leverage to manipulate or as tools of power. So imagine that instead of caring for your spouse or your children, you use them as a source of attention or admiration. Or instead of taking constructive criticism or feedback from your performance at work, you tell everyone that tries to help you that they're wrong. So when we talk about NPD or narcissistic personality disorder, we talk about, like Kat said, a series of coping strategies that began as an adaptation to childhood family situations that left the person with an unstable sense of self or unstable self-esteem. And it's that inability to regulate their self-esteem with external validation. So like I said, it might be someone who didn't have a lot of positive reinforcement as a child. And they then develop really low empathy. And that is one of the traits that I think really signifies narcissism, is that real inability to be able to empathize with others and that lack of emotional development. So as with the three major categories of personality disorders, borderline, narcissistic, and schizophrenia, people with NPD also lack the whole object relations and object constancy. So whole object relations, this is the capacity to see oneself and others in stable and integrated ways. So what that means is when I look at Kat, I recognize her as a whole person. Yeah, so I know that she has good qualities. I know that she has limitations, that she's not perfect, that she is not going to be able to meet every single one of expectations that life throws at her, because I see her as a holistic way.
A flawed human. Yeah, as everybody is.
Not even flawed, just human.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know that her as a whole person has limitations and strengths. Whereas someone with narcissism doesn't have that ability. So they see someone, it's almost like compartmentalizing. That's how I think of it. So someone with narcissism might see someone and think, okay, you know what? You're below me because you can't do X, Y, and Z, or you didn't meet my unrealistic expectations. So you're now not worthy. So that's one part. And then we have object constancy. And that is the ability to maintain a positive emotional connection to someone that you like while you're angry, hurt, frustrated, disappointed, etc. So often people that are in a relationship with someone with narcissism, it might feel like one minute they are completely in love with you and the next minute they hate you. And that is got to do with object constancy. And that's because when a narcissistic person feels anger or disappointment, or you haven't met one of their needs, they confuse that emotion with hate. And a lot of the time people, like I said, do describe being with someone in a romantic relationship with someone as it's this really turbulent up and down of
hot and cold,
but like really extreme. So one minute they're completely in love with you, the next minute they hate you. And people with NPD can only see themselves and other people in one of two ways. Either they're special, unique, perfect, and, you know, in a really high status, or they're defective, worthless, garbage, low status. And this means that the person struggling with narcissistic issues cannot hold on to his or her good opinion and good feelings about someone once they notice that that person has a flaw. So they're now not worthy. The other person goes from being special and put on a pedestal to being devalued as nothing special. So that's the seesaw back and forth.
And I feel like also if a narcissist sees someone who can, you know, benefit them, then that's when the charm might come out. That's when they might start to really, really
definitely
turn on that, you know, the charming nature that they tend to have. And then as soon as that person can't benefit them anymore, it's goodbye. Like, definitely, you're dead to me. I don't even want to talk to you. I hate you, kind of thing. So that's kind of where the behavior comes from, the real up and down. And also going back to empathy, how you're saying that narcissists really don't have the emotional capacity to feel empathy. And I think that does come from a really tumultuous childhood often, because a lot of clients I've seen who are narcissists, they have been taught to only meet their own needs, right? So why should I give someone else empathy when I've been so badly hurt? They don't deserve my empathy. I'm just trying to meet my own needs. And it's kind of like every man for himself kind of mindset. It's a survival
mechanism. Or they literally haven't developed the psychosocial skills to develop empathy.
Yeah.
They just don't have the skills because of deep trauma or because of what's been modeled by their parents.
Sure.
So there are a few different ways narcissism is caused or the way it develops. And one of them is, your environment. Genetics also play a role. So like most personality disorders, a lot of studies show that there is a genetic factor is twin studies. Actually, one of the, I remember doing this in at uni, and I remember doing this because I was like, oh my God, what's going to come out in my family tree?
It really always makes you think about your own family,
doesn't it? It really does. So I have my mum's side of the family has a lot of narcissistic traits, and I remember being terrified of doing this exercise. But one of the, and I guess we'll talk a little bit more about this later, but really interesting, well, I find it really interesting, is that one of the treatments for helping someone with narcissistic traits is to show them their family tree. And it's so ironic because if you can point out that they have narcissistic traits in their family tree and that other family members have failed in improving those narcissistic traits or bettering themselves, they'll actually want to compete and be the best at improving themselves. Ah. So it doesn't, improvement for a narcissist doesn't come from a really heartfelt epiphany. It comes from like, okay, I need to be the best in my family tree at not being a narcissist.
More of a because everything really is a competition, and it's almost like I want people to see me as the best. So of course, that's actually really clever.
Yeah,
I've never used that before.
Yeah, so it's a really good, I guess, and like I said, it's really ironic, but it's a good way because we'll get into it later, but it is really hard to
They're
treat.
Quite defensive. Yeah. Very defensive. They do require longer than the 8 to 10 sessions.
Yeah, definitely. So like we said before, your environment, parents that put their child on a pedestal can foster the grandiose narcissism. And then we have trauma as well. Also, I did want to mention that cold, controlling parents can also contribute to vulnerable narcissism. So it doesn't even have to be like deep trauma or abandonment. It can just be really critical, cold parents.
And also another factor that can really foster a sense of narcissist is having really overachieving siblings and often being the youngest. Birth order has a really big impact on narcissism because I think if you're in a family that maybe do value really high achievements and your siblings are high achievers, then sometimes narcissism can be a protective mechanism if maybe the second or third child is not as high achieving. But it can kind of almost be like this, look, mum, I'm really good at this too, even though they might not be. So it's a real, can really come from sibling rivalry as well, which is really interesting.
Definitely. And you touched on this point earlier, but just popped into my head. So, social media, so the whole idea of self-promotion, and we hear that a lot when we talk about narcissism. Someone posting a selfie, oh, they're narcissistic, they're in love with themselves, look at them. And although studies don't confirm that social media necessarily causes narcissism, there's no clear evidence, but social media rather provides narcissists a means to seek more validation, social status, and more attention.
And it's like really good to point out here, guys, narcissists are actually extremely insecure. And I think people who do post constantly, I know we touched on this in our very first episode, people who post more and more consistently on social media do tend to be quite insecure. So narcissism, they do have insight into their own insecurity, and they do have insight into that they do have low self-esteem. So it's not that they're completely in this fantasy world that they are actually the best of everything. They actually, studies have shown that they they do have insight in to know that they're actually not. And that's why where this overcompensation
comes. You know. So that would be your vulnerable narcissists. Your vulnerable narcissists are the ones that do it, it stems from insecurity. Whereas if we look at the grandiose narcissist or the NPD, like your clinical narcissist, it's just like being, it's the opposite of being a people pleaser. So they literally perceive themselves as this entitled, you know, like I deserve special treatment. They don't have the capacity to see things in reality, and that's why it's so hard to treat narcissism or even to detect narcissism if you're in a relationship with someone. Often we don't realize until we're cohabitating because
you see all of them.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm sure we'll delve into some story time later. But yeah, it's just like people pleasers really don't believe that they are worthy. Like they believe that their self comes last. Narcissists are the opposite of people pleasers. So they believe that they come first. Yeah. They are, you know, they have that inflated ego that just tells them that they are superior. Mm. They are higher than everyone else. And that's what they believe.
Yeah.
So we've got to remember that that's the distorted perception. And actually, funnily enough, codependent or people pleasers and narcissists are really attracted to one another. So when it comes to relationships, people pleasers often seek narcissists and narcissists love people pleasers because people pleasers put themselves last, narcissists put themselves first. It's a really toxic attachment, but they are just, you know, like magnets to one another.
It's like my whole dating history. It all just makes sense. So people with NPD do have trouble handling anything they perceive as criticism, as Aim said before. So people who are narcissists become very impatient or angry when they don't receive special treatment. They may have significant or extremely significant interpersonal problems and do often feel like things aren't fair. If things don't go their way, they do tend to react with rage or contempt and do try to belittle the other person to make themselves appear more superior. They have extreme difficulty regulating emotions and behavior because, as Aim said, they might not have ever developed that emotional skills and the emotional functionality to be able to do that. They experience major problems dealing with stress and adapting to change. Some of them have secret feelings of insecurity, shame, vulnerability, and humiliation. And some of them do have insight into knowing that others do see them less favorably, hence why they continue to manipulate or exert power and control over others. That when things don't go their way, that's how you can tell that they're maybe exhibiting these narcissistic traits.
And that comes out in that really manipulative, toxic behavior. So it might not even be in a romantic relationship. Like you might have a friend that after listening to this, you think, hang on a second.
Yeah.
So what that might look like in a friendship is almost like snide remarks. So those things that are kind of like backhanded compliments, or you might have someone that asserts their superiority over you, or just like little reminders that you're below them, or the opposite, that they're above you in certain ways, just to keep you in check. A narcissist will always want to be that kind of in control of everything, like to remind you that they're better than you, basically.
Like with small comments, like and it can be really sneaky. It can be like, oh, you look really good, you look better than you did yesterday. The real insult compliments, what are they called, compliments.
Yeah.
Because what that's doing is it's, oh, look, I'm being a really good friend and complimenting you, but what I'm also doing is undermining you and manipulating you to think that you didn't look so good yesterday. So it's really, really tricky when friends do this, but friends do this, and people in your life, and it can even be a boss. It can be work colleagues. It's really hard to pin down because you might think, oh, they paid me a compliment, but wait a second, why don't I feel good after that compliment?
Yeah, and I think that's so important. How do you feel after spending time with someone? That's a good little tip. Yeah, or it might just be something really simple, like your boss might say to you, oh, really good job on that. What a shame you didn't get it in last week.
Yeah.
After a fight, after a really intense fight, a romantic partner might be like, oh, but you know I love you. So it's like that little, it's almost like a little sandwich. It's that I'm being really nice, so I'm a good person, and therefore you'll stay with me. But also you're beneath me, but also like I'm nice.
Or even after a fight, they might say, I'm glad this is resolved and this is why you should never disagree with me. Mm. So it's almost like
they're always right.
I was right and you were wrong. Let's never do that again kind of thing. So it's almost like it's not a resolution. It's more just they're just trying to really exert that power and control over you. And I think a lot of narcissists do wear people down. And I think that's where that real, you know, the people pleasers or the helpers, they tend to, the empaths even, they tend to get quite worn down quite quickly because it's very easy to think, because narcissists are very skilled. They're very skilled manipulators. So this ain't their first rodeo, you know, they've had to do this as a child. So they probably know how to work people, how to get what they want out of people, especially people who are very empathetic and caring. And so it is very easy to get worn down with a narcissist.
So Kat, what is it like dating someone with narcissism?
Oh my gosh, it's honestly the most exhausting, awful time in my whole life. I dated someone who was a complete narcissist. He also was diagnosed with bipolar, so that made it fun, which is actually quite common to get the dual diagnosis of narcissism and bipolar. I almost feel, I remember I said to James, I felt embarrassed because, you know, I was an intelligent girl, I was studying psych, and to be really like charmed into a relationship like that, because at the beginning it was fireworks, it was amazing, he was really charming and said all the right things that I wanted to hear, but as time went on, it was actually quite a emotionally, psychologically and physically abusive relationship, and I didn't realize at the time, I always thought I was in trouble. I always thought I did the wrong thing. I always felt like exhausted, and because I was so exhausted, I remember this was, I just never wanted to fight. Like I was just like, I'd always just say, yep, you're right, I'm wrong, because I was so worn down, and that actually perpetuated his feelings of I'm in control, I've got the power and I'm right. So he would keep doing it because I kept validating that for him, but that was just because I was so exhausted. So it's exhausting, and if you're listening and you have dated someone who is a narcissist, you can probably really relate here and just know that getting out of it is hard. I think getting out of any relationship, because they will do anything that they can to stop you from getting out of that relationship.
100%. So there's actually a cycle. Most people aren't aware of the degrading, abusive and dehumanizing effect that the cycle of narcissism casts upon them. Like you said, Kat, you weren't aware at the beginning, and you're someone that's quite attuned to your psyche. Being in a relationship with a narcissist is confusing because of their lack of emotional comprehension. You're stuck between this cycle of loving you wholeheartedly and hating your guts. And I remember that relationship, and you were crazy about each other, but it was also extremely unhealthy. So the love cycle of narcissism.
Thanks,
James. Once, hey, look, I was your numero uno from day one. I always supported you. But yeah, you know. So, love cycle of narcissism. Once you realize you're in love with a narcissist, it's often too late to make an easy break for it. And Kat, you can vouch for that. Often it's not obvious until you're living with them, like I said earlier. Also, side note, if you've ever experienced trauma, you may have a subsequent bonding with the narcissist. Like I mentioned before, if you're a people pleaser or you have a really anxious attachment style, that further perpetuates the toxic attachment and love addiction. So the narcissist will spend a long time kind of love bombing you, basically. So they might shower you with gifts, appreciation, affection, make you feel like this is a love you've never had before. Like it's too good to be true. This is it. This is true love, like nothing you've ever experienced. And this is the first stage of the cycle. They want you to believe that this expression of love is genuine, and you'll be hooked on this feeling of being loved like a drug. Your oxytocin will be going through the roof. It will be crazy. And then they'll slowly limit your supply, like a drug dealer. Slowly the bliss fades and you'll begin to fight with degradation and devaluation. Somehow the fight will always be your fault, and you'll feel as though you haven't lived up to their expectations. Even when, for example, you might come to them with something that they've said to you that's hurt your feelings, and it will be turned around on you like it was your fault for coming to them in the first place.
Or you're crazy.
Really dismissive. The initial love bubble becomes a distant memory. However, there is just enough hope that things might get back on track with statements such as, like I mentioned, after a huge fight, they might say, you know, I love you. Mm. Or like you said, I'm glad we were able to work through this. Just don't do it again.
Mm.
After an argument. So narcissists need someone to kind of be their punching bag, yeah, in a sense. So someone to validate their own self-worth. Therefore, they are always the victim. You're the punching bag. They'll just keep wearing you down. Narcissists don't leave because you function as their personal assistant. You take care of them. You take all the responsibility. Why would they leave? Plus, they are comfortable unleashing their deepest abuse on you. And I definitely witnessed that with your relationship with Luke. He was one person in public around friends and different people. Very charming, very charismatic, but behind closed doors, he was a completely different person and displayed the most degrading behavior. But because you were in a state of prolonged exhaustion, another person might feel worthless, their self-esteem might take a real battering. They know you're not going to leave.
Mm.
They can sense that you've got no fire.
You don't leave, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And some narcissists hide their intentions really well as well. So they might say things like, I only do this because I love you. Yeah. I only fight this hard because I love you. Or you make me go crazy because I love you so much.
I've never loved anyone like you before. You make me crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that can be very addictive as well, especially if you're the the victim in this case, because people might not have said that to you before, and to hear something like that, it's very romanticized, it's very extravagant. And I think sometimes, I know for me, it felt like I was in the movies when I first started dating him, because it was like, I've never heard this before, this is what it's like, this is what I should have.
This is my big love.
Yeah, this is it. And then it can come crashing down.
Yeah. Which is the ultimate manipulation when you think about it. And narcissists can't admit failure. Leaving the relationship would mean they've made a mistake. Plus, they wouldn't be able to use the resentment against you. So that's another reason why they don't leave. Mm. Dating a narcissist can completely drain you of your sense of self-worth, and it can lead you to question everything you thought to be true about yourself. So like Kat was saying, she's standing there thinking, I'm a really educated woman. I'm a strong woman. I'm so independent, and I've studied psychology.
Mm.
Yet this was really difficult. Yeah. And I think, you know, no one is immune. To being in a really toxic narcissist relationship, because they go through this last phase, which is the devalue and discard phase of the cycle, where the narcissist knows that you will stick around because you have experienced their good side in the beginning. It's like, imagine being trapped in a square filled with water, and you have just enough of a little gap to get a little gasp of air. And that is what keeps you in the relationship. You have that tiny little gasp of hope that things will return back to the way they were at the start, when they feel that you deserve it, though. Because this good side isn't really a good side. The good beginning, or the amazing beginning, wasn't real. It was a facade and part of the abuse. And so the cycle continues. Mm.
And often narcissists don't realize what they're doing. I mean, until you really break it down with them, which can be quite tricky in itself. This is a subconscious or unconscious behavior that they have learned, and they might not realize what they're doing. But depending on people's reactions, this continues to perpetuate their behavior. So as you're saying, Ames, I guess some other common behaviors or signs of a narcissist, they tend to know it all. The narcissist may position themselves at home, at work, or in a social situations. We all have that friend or colleague that is just the know-it-all, don't we? They are the expert, they're the authority, they're constantly correcting and invalidating others' point of view. They tend to be the conversation hoarders, the conversation hogs. They tend to almost, you know, those people that want you to hurry up to finish what you're saying because they've got a better story. Those kind of people. Even when they're not criticizing or correcting your views, they may listen briefly and then go right back to what they were talking about, as if what you said didn't even matter at all. You exist merely as a convenient tool for their supply and validation. That's really helpful to know with narcissists as well. They do tend to hog conversations, and they don't tend to listen really to what you're saying. They're just thinking of the next thing to say that's going to make them sound really good and get that validation, because, you know, the validation to them is like a drug. They need it a lot and they need it constantly. So they'll do whatever they can to get that off other people. Narcissists like to have control over everything. Narcissists may target and position themselves in a professional or personal relationships with those who allow them to, as we're saying before, the empaths, the helpers, that allow them to dominate, judge, criticize, or marginalize them on a regular basis. The narcissist is very fulfilled by controlling others, and when others bend the narcissist, this perpetuates and validates their self-dialogue that they are important and more powerful than most other people. Also, another really interesting to note with narcissists is they do, in terms of control, they may tend to control you. So they can cut you off from your family and your friends as well as a way to manipulate you and to have further control over you as well. Because generally, from the outside, Ames, you can probably speak to this, but, you know, seeing someone go through a relationship with a narcissist, you might think, what are you doing? Get out of there. Like, you need to leave. And that is very threatening to a narcissist because you don't have the emotional connection with them. So there's no way they can control you. But what they can do is control how close you are to your friends and family if you are someone who is, you know, seeing a narcissist. So that's a really clever way that they use it. And they might say things like, I know that your friend doesn't like you. They told me they don't like you. So it's better that, you know, I'm helping you out here. Or I know that your parents, they're not looking out for your best interests. I know your parents are just jealous of me. Or I know your brothers or sisters, they don't like me, which is unfair. So you better not talk to them, kind of thing. So that's actually very common to exert that control and power as well. Also, narcissist aims, I think you talked about this before, but they love to gaslight. Gaslighting is a form of manipulation and emotional abuse, and it is the hallmark of narcissism. Narcissists will tell lies, falsely accuse others, spin the truth, and ultimately end up distorting your reality of what's true and what's not true. So, signs of gaslighting. Have you ever been gaslighted before?
Probably. Yeah. Now that I come to think about it. Who hurt you?
Who hurt you? Okay, signs of gaslighting include the following. You no longer feel like you're the person you used to be. You feel a lot more anxious and a lot less confident than what you used to be. You often wonder if you're being too sensitive. You feel like you do everything wrong. You feel like you're constantly walking on eggshells. You apologize often. You have a sense that something's always wrong, but you're not ever able to identify what it is. You often question whether your emotional response to your partner is appropriate, and you often make excuses for your partner's behavior. So gaslighting, it's that classic, you're crazy, or I don't know why you feel like that. Like, you're emotional, it's your period.
I think you hit the nail on the head when you said it's like walking around on eggshells and you question whether your reaction is right.
Yeah.
Because as we know, in healthy relationships, your reaction to anything
is right.
Is right. And I think when you're with someone that really makes you cautious of how you react to something and question whether you're responding appropriately to your partner's expectations, that's a really telling sign that something's not right there.
Absolutely, yeah. A normal healthy relationship, they'd let you validate that what you're feeling is absolutely correct. So another sign is that people who are narcissistic do not handle rejection well. This can trigger a trauma response. They have a fear of abandonment or rejection, and they will use all the tactics in their book to ensure that you don't leave. They may lash out. They'll go to extremes. They might have extreme manipulation or threats. So, for example, if you leave me, I'll do this. I will hurt you, or I will, I don't know. I remember Luke always used to say, if you leave me, I'm going to call your boss and tell them what a bad worker you are. And looking back, I was like, oh my God.
Or I dated someone that had narcissistic traits, and he would block the only exit out of the room and say, you're not leaving, but if you do leave, that's it. Like, we're done.
That's it.
It's finished. End. Yeah.
Yeah. It's that real all or nothing. Why do we date these people?
Because we're people pleasers.
Fucking empaths. Oh, it's not all bad being an empath, guys.
It's really not.
A lot of you listening are. You just got to find the right person. It doesn't take advantage of you. But I think being an empath as well, it's very easy to get taken advantage of.
Definitely. Because we're rescuers.
We love to help.
That's a whole other topic.
For another day.
Maybe we could do another episode on empaths.
Yeah, I think that's a really good one. And I guess maybe just learning about narcissism or manipulation in relationships is just, it's a really good tool to start to stand up for yourself, but completely get it. If you're listening and you're like, oh my God, I'm getting taken advantage of.
What's one advice you would give to your younger self now after experiencing that relationship?
That's a really tricky one. And you know what? I wasn't ready to leave until I was. And I think everybody told me to leave. I could see it from everybody's perspective. I could see it from mine. But until I was ready to leave, I couldn't. Because if there was even a glimmer of hope that it would work, I would stay. It was until that little glimmer got literally squashed that I realized that then it's my time to leave. And I think you need to leave when you're ready to leave and when you've got the energy to leave. I think you need to have a lot of energy. And I think when you do finally leave, make sure you've got a heap of support around you to make sure that you don't go back. But yeah, you have to be ready to leave, and it's exhausting. I remember when I knew I was going to break up with him, I remember just feeling exhausted just even thinking about it. That's why I didn't. So you need to have a bit of energy. You need to have a bit of time. You need to have a bit of your girlfriends, your guy friends around you. You need that pep talk as well. So it's exhausting.
What's one thing that helped you?
To be honest, I say this with a lot of relationships, but nothing helps you move on faster more than anger. And I was extremely angry. It's a very powerful emotion in the way that it can make you, it made me move on so quickly. I think that really helped, being angry. And I think, to be honest, learning about it, I think obviously as a psych, I did know about it. But when you're in the moment, when it's a personal relationship, you're not a psychologist. Like, I was his girlfriend. I wasn't, you know, a trained professional looking from the outside in. So learning about it, understanding that it wasn't my fault, and that none of it was my fault, and understanding that this was a absolutely classic pattern of his behavior, and it was nothing to do with me, it was more to do with his childhood, I think that really, really helped me as well, because I was like, yes, it's not me. Like, I thought I was crazy, I thought there was something wrong with me, I thought I was flawed. I am flawed, but I thought that, you know, obviously I was weak. I remember thinking I was really weak, because I'm like, how could I let this guy stamp all over me? I question my own judgment with relationships, because I was like, man, I'm educated, I'm strong, I'm independent, how could I choose someone like this? But I think learning about it, you know, narcissists are very charming, and they turn it on, and they will tell you anything that you want to hear. So I think,
no, that's really great advice. And I think a lot of people can really relate to those feelings of, you know, unworthiness and questioning yourself and questioning your own judgment, because that kind of manipulation and that narcissist cycle does exactly that. It really wears you down and drains your sense of self to the point where you do question, well, is what I know true?
Yeah. And you know, narcissists feed off power. They feed off reactions. The less you fight, the less of reaction you give them, the less power they're going to have over you. The less you honestly care, the less power they've got over you, and they're starting to fail and they're starting to freak out. So they will respond with these, you know, huge acts of, you know, I remember it was like big gestures. The grand gestures. I'll come to your door because I can feel you slipping away from me. That's not romantic. That's a manipulation tactic. So just really remember that when you start to back away, the grand gestures can seem really romantic and, you know, really exciting. But, you know, just remember that it's probably a well thought out tactic to get you back, because they're so scared of losing you. That's probably my advice.
Great advice. I think a lot of people will benefit from hearing that insight. So the question you're all wondering, can a narcissist improve on those negative traits? Well, short answer, yes, but it is extremely difficult because, like we've mentioned, narcissists really struggle with self-reflection and thinking of themselves from an unflattering or
being challenged or criticized.
So it is really, really hard. Like I mentioned, you kind of have to use their narcissistic traits
to their advantage.
So any improvement, and this is the harsh reality of working with a narcissist clinically. So what I would do as a clinician is I would obviously accept that no improvement comes from a really heartfelt epiphany. That's just not a reality of someone that's been diagnosed with NPD or that has the grandiose narcissism. The vulnerable narcissism would be trauma work. Mm. That's a little bit different. But for the let's just stick to NPD, you would, like I said, the family tree activity is a really good exercise to use with people just to really teach them how narcissistic traits are caused and how they develop. And then to be like, well, look, you know, you could be the best at challenging your narcissistic traits, and that will really help them. And that strategy pretty much works in most domains or most facets of life. So you might, again, at work, if they are abusing their power as a boss or practicing manipulative tactics at work, you might flip that on its head and be like, well, you know, what makes a good boss? And you might go through all the traits that make a good boss and you might be like, are you being the best boss? And you know, they might be like, okay, well, if I do this, 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 and this, I'm being the best boss and elevating their ego that way, but getting them to perform in a more seemingly empathic manner, which isn't empathy, but it's still kind of teaching. So they don't have the psychosocial skills, but we're teaching them behavioral skills, or we're learning behavioral skills that are less toxic and more healthy. So anything that promotes honest reflection in their behavior is really good. So reflecting on caring for others, and psychotherapy is really great for that, and practicing compassion towards others as well can also be really helpful.
Yeah, I was gonna say that humanity, the humanitarian work can be really helpful for people with narcissism, that helping other people can really start to hone those empath skills that they do lack as well. But yeah, as you're saying, making sure that there's a benefit to what they're doing, you know, I think a really good way, if you do have a narcissist, especially, like, I know this is something that's worked for me previously with a narcissist, is that if they, I mean, think about it, that in a relationship, they're wanting that person to stay as long as they can. And so educating them that if they treat this person in a really nice way, an appropriate way, that they're more likely to stick around for longer. So really working out what their motivations are and working backwards from that and making it really beneficial for them, because chances are they do want this person to stay around forever. It's just working out a way that they can do that and make the other person happy as well. So yeah,
that's a good one. Motivations and drives.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it does take a bit of therapy, guys. Narcissism is not something you can, and if you're listening and you maybe have a parent figure, friend or partner, you can't do this on your own. Narcissism, it's not an easy thing. You're probably already worn down, so make sure that you do reach out for some help, and make sure you have a good support network, because personally I know how exhausting it is to date a narcissist.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that's really, really good advice. Make sure if you are someone dating, or you've got parents or even grandparents that are narcissists, and you know you've been really affected by it, make sure that you have a good support system, or that you engage with a therapist or a service that can really help support you during that.
Couple therapy could be helpful if you are dating someone who's a narcissist. You do just need to find the right therapist, because generally a therapist will challenge a narcissist, so you do need to find one that's quite gentle with them. Alrighty, it is question time.
Questioni. So first question we have, well, there are two that kind of, well, there are a couple actually that kind of relate. Mm-hmm. So how to get over someone. So this listener says, I broke up with someone but still feel sad. How do I move on, especially with isolation? Mm. And another listener has said, my long-term boyfriend is moving away in 4 days. How do I work on being less dependent on them? So the last one may not have necessarily broken up, but I think the theme here is, how do we cope with being separated from someone?
Okay, so what was the first one?
How do I get over someone? I broke up with someone but still feel sad. How do I move on, especially in isolation?
Okay, so I think for this one as well, there is no rush to move on. I mean, I know that there is this very glamorized idea out there that you do need to move on and party and see all your friends and whatever you need to do, but there is absolutely no rush to move on. I think I'd be questioning why you're feeling like you need to move on. So, I mean, I don't know how long ago your breakup was. Yes, it is healthy to move on, but it's also very normal to ruminate especially when you're alone, especially in isolation. I think it might take a little bit longer when you don't have that support network of your friends around you and activities to keep you busy. So I would probably question, you know, where this need to move on really quickly comes from. Some relationships you never move on from. You always will have a little part of that relationship within you that you can't resolve, and that's unfortunately life sometimes.
Yeah, I think perhaps it's about when you first separate from someone, whether it be a breakup or distance, it's painful. And I think the thing that we want to alleviate is the pain that's caused when we go through a breakup. And I think one of the most effective strategies to alleviate pain, especially if you are in isolation and you don't have your usual strategies like going to the gym or, you know, going out with your friends, it can make things really difficult. So I completely empathize with this listener. It is a very difficult situation and really bad timing for a breakup, given that a lot of our self-care methods might not be accessible at this time. But what I would say is still go with distraction. I think apps like House Party are really great. If you can download House Party and still have, you know, quality time with your friends virtually, still practice self-care in whatever means you have available. Go for a walk, you know, you've got an hour a day outside, get in some nature, do an at-home pamper session. Still reach out, still connect, call your friends, call your family, maybe write a letter. We always say how effective letters can be. And even if you don't end up giving it to that person, writing it down can be really therapeutic.
Externalize how you're feeling. Also, you know, if you feel like a romantic distraction, online dating, that's still available, that's still happening. It's to talk to, you know, romantic partners. I mean, sometimes that is something that can really help people. It's just a distraction. It's just someone else that they can put their energy and thoughts into as well. So that's something. Yeah,
but I agree with your first statement that you don't necessarily have to rush to move on. I think sometimes just acknowledging that this is really hard, this is really
sit in the shit.
Acknowledge your feelings.
We always say you need to just feel the feelings. The more you try to avoid them, push them away, the longer it will take you to move on. So feel,
journal,
cry,
scream,
rage, listen to angry music, sad music. That's all completely okay. That's actually regulating. You're regulating when you do those things. So really important that you don't push those feelings away, and take your time with it. Probably not what you wanted to hear, but really important that you do.
Definitely. I think something that's really helped me move on from a breakup would be just speaking, connection with friends. I think talking cat's ear off in depth about breakups and everything, and really, like, I'm someone who overthinks everything, so really just, even if you just talk to yourself, like, it might feel silly at first, but it's something that I did a lot. I would just talk out loud about all my feelings, and it really just helps process and let go. Okay, so the other one that kind of related to that question, but perhaps not in the same boat as a breakup, is my long-term boyfriend is moving in 4 days. How do I work on being less dependent on him?
So he's moving out?
I'm assuming he's, yeah, it just says, my boyfriend is moving in 4 days. How do I work on being less, I'm guessing moving away?
Okay.
Long distance relationships are tricky. There is no doubt about that. In terms of being less dependent, I think focus on what your values are, what gives you purpose, what gives you meaning in your everyday. Yeah, I'd say focus on that.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, it's very easy to get caught up and to have these intertwined identities, especially with someone who has been your partner for a long time. And we do often forget the things that make us us. So you might, before you met your partner, had a really interesting hobby. You might have been into sports. You might have really enjoyed singing or painting or craft. And sometimes when we do get into these long-term relationships, we tend to mesh our identities as one. And we do forget those parts of us that we really enjoyed and really loved. So really helpful to revisit those things that you, that make you you, and things that you love doing separate from your partner. Or even, I know with clients that do struggle with the identity following either a breakup or if their partner's moving away, just brainstorming words that come to mind or asking their friends or family how to describe this person, things that they love, because it can be so hard to remember those things.
100%. And I think that's one of the biggest things that I'm speaking like from clients and my own experiences, you go from being a pair, a partnership, to an individual. And sometimes I think that's the roughest blow. Even if it is just long distances, you kind of have to relearn how your life. So that can be really tricky. But I think, go back to things that make you and give you purpose and meaning and things that you really value.
I think also having some outlet as well. So making sure that if you're into sports, you play them sports, you paint, you vent, you do what you need to, and keeping up like I know a long distance can be quite anxiety provoking because you might not have the control over when you can talk to them. So ensuring that you do have a consistent time to talk to them and having boundaries, because I think if it's always the unknown of, oh, are we going to call? Where are they? I mean, I don't know where your partner's going. I mean, there might be somewhere where it's impossible for them to call at a consistent time, but really good to try and keep up a consistency so you're not constantly waiting by the phone.
100%.
So you've got that time to be like, okay, I've had my hour with him. Now I can go and do my own thing. Now I've got that time to go and just explore the things that I want to do.
Definitely. That's a really good point. And on that as well, something that can really help with that point is schedule the next time you're going to talk or the next date you're going to see each other. Because if you always have a date that you know you're definitely going to talk or see each other written down, it alleviates some of that anxiety. Yeah. But yeah, that's a really, really important factor.
Yeah, absolutely. So good luck with that one. It's a tricky one. And connecting with girlfriends again. I mean, sometimes in a relationship, we tend to forget our girlfriends or we forget our wider circle of friends. And this is a really important time to fill your life with other relationships, family, making constant dates with your mom or your friends, like, you know, having a consistency that isn't your partner and a constant in your life that isn't your partner can be really helpful as well.
100%. Your partner should just add to your life. They should just be a nice little cherry on top. They shouldn't be your whole reason for being. So yeah, that's really important to make sure we're focusing on lots of different aspects. Okay, next question.
Ready.
This is quite a good one. Okay. Tips on dealing with jealousy and partner having close female friends.
Okay, guys, just also want you to know, Ames and I just improvise these answers. Never prepared. So it takes a bit of thinking.
We kind of just scramble, and sometimes I say things and I'm like, oh gosh, should I have said that?
No, I think you do so well, Ames. Jealousy can sometimes, I'm not saying all the time, but it can stem from some insecurity. So maybe exploring that first, exploring your insecurities and understanding, has an insecurity occurred from that partner or from a previous relationship or a previous relationship with maybe someone who's non-intimate, like parents, friends, etc. Exploring that before you go kind of into the relationship and I guess project that jealousy on them can be really helpful as well.
Yeah.
And have they given you a reason to be jealous? Look for the evidence. We always say this. Sometimes our thoughts are not always fact. We tend to kind of get stuck in our heads. So look for the evidence to, has anything clear cut happened that has made you feel worried? Or is this maybe an insecurity rearing its ugly head, as it tends to do when you're in a new relationship or when a threat, you know, our brain perceives another female or another romantic partner as a threat. So making sure we go back to that really factual, looking for the evidence, I think would be really helpful for this situation.
Yeah, I was going to say exactly the same thing. And also, jealousy is normal. I feel like we all get jealous from time to time. It's a completely natural, normal emotion to feel. But like Kat said, I would just really reflect on where that jealousy has come from and if you have any evidence or any reason to be worried about.
And getting to know the person that you're jealous about can be really helpful to dispel that jealousy, because you probably realize that they're actually are just a friend and they'll probably want to spend time with you as well. So spending time with just them away from your partner can be really helpful as well.
That's really good advice. Why do so many boys have commitment issues?
Fuck, preach. I think we actually covered that. What episode was it? Man, they blow into one. We've just done so many because we're such superstars.
We are.
What is that one we did about men and dating?
I can't remember, but we have delved into this. So men are genetically predispositioned to sow their seed. So coming from an evolutionary biological perspective, men are actually hardwired to have sex with as many fertile women as possible to create more offspring. So a lot of men obviously have an innate drive to keep having sex with lots of different women. However, the human mind is very, very complex, and, you know, we fall in love and we have a societal construct that creates monogamy. Yeah. So I guess in a very, very, very nutshell way of explaining it, boys have trouble with commitment because they have a genetic predisposition not to commit.
And also they mature a lot later than females. So while they're a bit younger, they've got those impulsive urges that they can't control to have lots of sex. So when they're younger, up until really late 20s, that's when they start to mature emotionally. They have these drives, these automatic drives to have sex with as many women as they can. So if I guess a relationship is on the table, then I think also, you know, they might think, oh, I'm not ready. Like, I've still got these drives. I want to have sex with as many women as I can. I'm in my prime. I've got all this testosterone going through my body. Mm. So it's a really classic case of it's probably not you, it's just them.
100%.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, and I think also, I guess from a male perspective as well, it's not like, I get it. I mean, you know, boys, they don't set out to hurt feelings, but I think when you're driven by instincts and testosterone, that's really hard to control, especially when you don't have that impulse control developed. Mm. So it generally really is just an innate biological thing. And often it's not until late 20s or early 30s that men do start to settle down and want relationships more.
Mm. Yeah. And one piece of advice, I can't remember where I heard it from, but it's that the right guy at the wrong time is still the wrong guy.
Absolutely.
And what that means is if you're not on the same page as a guy you're talking to, whether it be that you don't have the same maturity or you're not looking for the same, you don't have the same fundamental expectations at that current time, then it's not a case of so many boys not having commitment issues. It's just a case of you're on two different pages. You'll find someone that's on the same page as you.
Yeah. All right, so we got one more question, and I think we might have said this in a previous episode: family relationships, how to set boundaries with parents and older figures. I think the episode was about toxic relationships. There was also an episode we did on how to say no. Listen to those episodes. If you're still not feeling like we've answered your question, write us again, and we will answer that maybe in a separate episode.
Because we do go quite in depth in setting boundaries in those ones. Yeah,
really helpful to have a listen to those as well. All right, guys, well, we have had a big episode, but we hope you enjoyed a little bit of a change from coronavirus talk, the C word. So we wanted to bring you an episode that was a little bit interesting, and narcissism is so interesting, and we all know someone who is narcissistic, and I guess ways to deal with it is really helpful as well. But please know you're not crazy and you haven't done anything wrong. It's more to do with them.
Definitely.
Yeah. All right, guys, thanks for listening. We will catch you next episode.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks so much for tuning in to today's episode. If you want to see more, please feel free to follow us on Instagram at The Psychology Sisters. To make sure that you never miss another episode, please hit the subscribe button in the podcast app. If you know someone who might enjoy this episode, we would love you to share this with them. Please note, the content shared in this episode is purely educational and does not replace personalized advice from a mental health professional. See you next week for more spicy science and sexy self-help.